from the ACLU. This is At Liberty. I'm Kendall Seesmeyer, your host. This Friday, July 26th, the Summer Olympics will kick off in Paris, France. And I don't know about you all, but there's nothing that brings out my patriotism like watching the Olympic Games. I love the Olympics, the athletes, the storylines, the dreams being made, the records being broken. So to commemorate this year's Olympic Games, we have a special treat for all of you. Today we are joined by five-time Olympic gold medalist, Sue Bird. Sue Bird is widely known as one of the greatest basketball players in modern history. Her name is often followed or preceded by the word legend. Sue was a champion from a young age. In college, she was a two-time NCAA champion playing for the University of Connecticut. She then went on to the WNBA, where she was named a four-time champion with the Seattle Storm and a 13-time WNBA All-Star. Need I remind you that she also has five Olympic gold medals? Sue retired in 2022 after 21 years in the WNBA. And now she spends her time working to advance gender equity in women's sports, be it through her media and commerce company Together, her production company with her partner in work and life, soccer phenom Megan Rapinoe, and her partial ownership of the Seattle Storm, which again is her former WNBA team. A documentary about Sue's career, Sue Bird in the Clutch, recently premiered at the 2024 Sundance Film Festival and is available now on Netflix. Sue joins us at a very exciting time in women's sports, and we are going to break it all down with her right now. Sue, welcome to At Liberty, and thank you so much for joining me. I'm shamelessly so excited to be talking with you.
No, I'm excited too. Thank you for having me.
So first off, the Olympics are upon us. As I mentioned, the opening ceremony is on Friday. This is your first Olympics as a retired athlete. I did see that both you and Megan got to take part in the Olympic torch relay when you were in the south of France about a month ago. What was that like, and where's your head at as we approach these games?
The torch relay was great. You know, Megan was, I guess, like the official torch carrier in that moment, but there was a couple of us athletes who were also in Cannes at the time. A couple of us got to basically run with her and surround her. And we had these like all white uniforms on. So we just kept joking, like everywhere we walked, we were like on our way to go get this torch. And I just kept feeling, it was like, I feel like we're going to the moon. I feel like this is like that final walk you see astronauts do before they take their big voyage. We really enjoyed that though, because even though we look like astronauts all dressed the same, what a cool thing to help bring the torch along. And that's something we had never done, something I had never done. I've had a ton of Olympic experiences, but that was the first.
It's awesome to still get an Olympic first, even as a retired athlete. You competed in five Olympics and won all five times, which is quite the record. It's so rare that someone can say that. What's the best part of the Olympics to you, having been there so many times?
Yeah, it's tough to pick. I do think opening ceremonies is probably my favorite. When the Olympics comes around, we get very proud, right? We feel very American. We want to wave the flag. We want to do all the things. And as an athlete, that really exists during opening ceremonies. Because the minute the competition starts, you obviously have an awareness of all of that, but you're so focused on what you're doing in your sport. It's not at the forefront. So I think opening ceremonies, all the athletes get together. You can feel the pride. Everybody's on the same team in a sense. It's really a joy. And then of course, when they announce the United States walking in, you know, as we start to walk into the main arena, the amount of cheering, the way people get hype, like that moment right before we get out of the tunnel and into the arena is probably one of my favorites.
Yeah, it sounds pretty incredible. I want to pivot to talking about women's sports more broadly, specifically the WNBA. NBA just announced a new media rights deal with Walt Disney, NBC, and Amazon that boosts the payout for NBA clubs by more than 150% on average. The news is even better for the WNBA clubs, which will receive a 500% gain on what they previously made. But I think it's important to go back to context. The NBA's deal is worth $75 billion, with the WNBA only getting $2.2 billion of it. And while this marks this big annual increase of $200 million for the WNBA, it's still only a fraction of what the NBA is getting. We already know that in the 2023 to 2024 season, the average WNBA player salary was $116,580 compared to the average NBA player salary hitting over $12 million. So it's a perfect time to be asking you this question. What do you make of this deal? And is the NBA doing enough to promote equity given this rising WNBA tide?
I'm actually, I think, still in process of trying to see like how I feel about this, because everything you just said, right, it brings up two different emotions. One is excitement around the fact that we're being valued in the way that we are, given the significant increase from a percentage standpoint. You know, you mentioned some of the top salaries. I think this year's top WNBA salaries is in like the $240,000 to $50,000 range, which even to the numbers from a couple of years ago is this increase, right? But at the same exact time, you're like, wait, are we still being undervalued? And I think what's always been really probably one of the biggest obstacles in the WNBA on the business side of things is feeling like we got bundled, feeling like we're this add-on, you know? And in some ways, again, it's gonna be a lot of two things being true at the same time. I think for a long time, the fact that the NBA made sure that, you know, whether it was brands or corporate sponsorships or media deals, I think the fact that the NBA always made sure that we got some piece of that pie was beneficial. It kept us afloat in a sense. It kept the league going for as long as it did. But now we're at this point where you have to wonder, would it be more beneficial to unbundle? And I always, the analogy I kind of use is, it's like, imagine owning the penthouse of a building. The rest of the building is one bedroom apartments. You own the penthouse, but they're all being sold for the same price. They're just taken out to market, same price, and you get to buy the whole thing. You never know what your actual value is as that individual apartment. But that actually was the case for women's college basketball as well. Mm. They've been bundled and bundled for years and years, whereas men's college basketball got to go out on their own. And I think the thing that bugs me the most in that is that people then get it twisted when they go out and they have their talking points, that whatever money we did get, that was the final, that's the most we could have gotten. And they never understand this bundling aspect. But with that being said, I could sit here and make a ton of arguments as to why I wish we could have sold it on our own and just see what our own market value is, right? Like, that's when you find out what your market value is, when you have different people, you know, making their different pitches and kind of putting that money forth. But at the end of the day, I'm thankful for the deal. I'm also thankful for the fact that I believe in 3 years, we get to circle back and see how this is going. Because an 11-year deal, really, I wasn't thrilled. I thought we could have gotten more. That to be locked in for 11 years is a long time. But I think there's this like 3-year period where we can kind of come back to the table and see if it's working. And I don't know, the WNBA All-Star Game, it just got released that it had the highest viewership on ESPN for any WNBA event, games, draft, you name it.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people in the last 3, 4, 5 months have been like, oh, is this just this one moment? Is it like a flash in a pan? Is it going to die down? Is it going to plateau? And clearly the answer is that it's just continuing to grow. And I would just love for people to realize that and start investing in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like year to year, the WNBA is growing. Already in 2024, the season has seen record-breaking attendance. Viewership has nearly tripled to 1.3 million average viewers, and more than half of the games have been sellouts, which is so significant. And I agree with you that an 11-year deal would be really difficult to account for what seems to feel like exponential growth. Does it feel like exponential growth to you? And do you think that this deal can even begin to keep pace with what the growth is that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's definitely exponential growth. We saw it. It started in women's college basketball. The viewership records like out of this world. You know, it obviously does have a lot to do with this rookie class. I think Caitlin and Angel Reese, especially, you can name other names as well, Cameron Brink. The thing with women's basketball that's a little different from men's is that our college game is ahead of us. It's ahead of the pro game. It's had a longer time to build. It's now gotten to that point where it has generational fan bases. And then of course it's college. So, you know, like for me, I went to UConn. No matter what year, what day, what time, what team, it doesn't matter. If a UConn team is on its way to a championship, I am all in, die hard, doesn't matter. And so they have a lot of that fan base built in. And so I bring that up to say, all of those players that came from college, now that college basketball had its boom, right? They've taken that with them to the WNBA, and they've met up to the WNBA's, with the WNBA's momentum that I would say, even though the league is 28 years old, I would say it's really in the last like 5 years that we've seen this like turn of momentum. And so it's really a perfect storm. Those two things have collided in this wonderful way, and we're seeing the numbers that we're seeing. And I think, you know, to get back to the actual question, I think it's going to continue to grow. I think there's something special right now in the WNBA. There's something I've never seen. I think we've crossed over into the cultural capital and cachet of society in a different way.
I'm glad that you brought up the new incoming rookie class from the NCAA. The NCAA women's final scored 4 million more viewers than the men's NCAA final. That was a huge moment, it seemed. And it felt like, okay, suddenly I'm hearing not just women's basketball fans talk about women's basketball. There was a lot more excitement, it seemed, even from sports broadcasters commentating and talking about the women's game. As you mentioned, a lot of the excitement has centered on Caitlin Clark as a record breaker. But you also mentioned a few other names. There's a lot of rookie stars in the league. Camila Cardoza, Rikia Jackson, Aaliyah Edwards, Angel Reese, to name a few. One of the things that, you know, I thought was notable that you mentioned in the documentary, In the Clutch, is this kind of consistent bias with what we see across all different facets of society and media coverage, for sure, this anti-Black bias that exists. I was wondering while watching this and hearing your thoughts about it, is this an open conversation amongst players? Are they able to employ like tactics to kind of lift each other up? Or is there a culture of that in the WNBA?
Absolutely. We're all very aware that we're women. We're all very aware that, you know, our league is majority Black. Our league is majority, you know, part of the LGBTQ plus community. We're all very aware of that. And we're people, in a sense, we're people of the world, right? Like our status or celebrity hasn't removed us from the impacts of society and the world outside of sport. So we're all very aware. It was a big part of all of our conversations during our negotiations where we did our last CBA. Then came the pandemic, which turned into negotiations to get into that bubble season that we all saw in 2020, wanting it to stand for social activism. So we're all very aware. I think that's kind of the beauty of the WNBA, is that even though we're super competitive on the floor, and it doesn't always mean everybody likes each other, because of course you're competing, so stuff's gonna happen. We're also really very supportive of the fact that we're all kind of in this same boat in all different ways, right? Like obviously I'm not Black, but my teammates are. And so learning from them and kind of seeing their existence is going to help inform and allow me to educate myself in a different way. Same thing, some of my teammates aren't gay. So then they get to see how my life is, that kind of a thing. And it's really supportive. It's a place where you can have honest conversations. And yeah, this is probably the biggest obstacle of all, is that all the communities that are marginalized in America exist in the WNBA. You know, and then you add on that, you know, there's a spectrum of whether, you know, you're super feminine or maybe a little more on the masculine side. And, you know, how does society respond to that part of it as well? So there's all kinds of things, sadly, in that melting pot that have been held against us. But yeah, the beauty of the WNBA is, I think, the support. It's why we're such I think dynamic people. I think that's why you're going to see a lot of female athletes absolutely kill it when it comes to the work they do with brand, being in the community. Like, we are people of this world. And again, it's almost forced us to be the most dynamic version of ourselves. But that's actually going to that's what's going to propel this. That's what's going to make this league continue to grow. It's going to be what makes this league exciting, because it's going to be on the court excitement as well as off the court excitement.
I agree. And I also think that there is a certain viewer of women's sports that are also, you know, predominantly women themselves, who are interested in not just the game or the plays or the points, but the people playing the sports, the storylines within the league, the like human interest side of things. In a recent interview that you did with Fresh Air, you mentioned that you think your career in the WNBA have had parallel paths in growth. And you specifically noted, which I found interesting, that what allowed the WNBA to turn a corner in its marketing and popularity is also what potentially allowed your growth as an athlete and culture creator, stepping into, you know, what makes you, your own uniqueness, et cetera. I was wondering if there was a turning point from your life when you began to sort of embrace this yourself, and if you think that the players themselves were embracing more of who they were in their life and the league followed suit, or was it vice versa?
Good question. It was the players. I think what you've seen in terms of what the WNBA has done and the growth it's had, let's call it, I like to stick to like that 5 year, maybe 6 year range. Yeah, what you've seen in the last 6 years with the WNBA is because the players have started to take ownership of themselves, of who they are authentically, and have really started to showcase that, right? Everything from maybe talking about personal things about themselves. Obviously for me, coming out in 2017 was a big pivotal moment for me, for sure. But then, so everything from something like revealing a part of yourself to showcasing your style.
Yeah, I was going to say fashion.
Yeah. Yeah. Fashion's a big part of it. And I think, I mean, I remember back when tunnel fits really became a thing, I think in our league, there was a couple players who were always doing it, like on their own without the photographer.
Who was doing it? Shout them out.
Crystal Langhorne. Okay. She called them game days instead of like game day fits. It was like, oh, I got my game day on. And Cappy Pondexter. These are two people that come to mind. They were doing it. We used to have to, matter of fact, Crystal Langhorne was a longtime teammate of mine. And what would happen is she would wear her game day. And after the game, she'd be like, I need someone to take the picture of me. And we'd be like, oh, fine. Because she was really picky about the angle. So it's like, you never really wanted to be that photographer. And if you go back in her Instagram, go like way back a couple of years, you'll see she was already doing it before there were actual quote unquote tunnel fits or tunnel picks. So yeah, so I think we started to lean into it probably like 2018, 19, I'd say, and obviously beyond. So I think we had to start showcasing that. I think younger generations, and by that I mean by the time, you know, in 2019 and 20, I'm like knocking the door on 40. So I'm talking about those that were in their early 20s at that point. This was a generation that was the exact opposite of shut up and dribble. They were like, no, no, no. We deserve all of this. This is ours, you know? And so they're the ones that really were pushing the envelope. And I think they grew up with social media. They understood how to like brand themselves or market themselves. I think that's what makes Angel Reese so special.
Yeah, I would agree.
She is grabbing this moment and running with it based on what she wants to do, how she wants to, I guess, project and put her brand out there. I think it's wonderful. That's not a mindset that any of us older players had. It just didn't exist in that way. So it's been really cool to see how all of that has interacted and gotten us to where we are now. And then I think the league like had to hear us loud and clear.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, the cult of personality coupled with the ability to call out for change and expose inequities, that's very, I mean, social media has empowered a lot of that. So it's kind of, you know, all of these different factors coming together to, I think, really elevate the league. I think the other really interesting thing here is the activism that has really come alongside the WNBA. I mean, when you talk about athlete activism, I immediately think of the WNBA as a league, but I remember, you know, months before Colin Kaepernick even took a knee on July 9th, 2016, four members of the Minnesota Lynx donned black t-shirts that read, "Change starts with us, justice and accountability," which ushered this larger wave. Their protest came just days after Philando Castile was shot and killed, and Alton Sterling as well. And the activism continued to kind of trickle out into other teams. What can you tell us about the growth of activism in the WNBA? And I'm imagining a lot of this was player-driven again. What has it been like to watch that kind of dynamic through your professional career?
Being a part of all of that, I feel a sense of pride. I feel energized by it. God, it was hard. there's so many difficult aspects to it. But at the end of the day, it really does circle back to what we've been talking about, which is the makeup of the WNBA. Us being, you know, when we walk out there, I think it was during the pandemic, actually, after George Floyd had been murdered, where Natasha Cloud publicly was like, "When I go home and I take this jersey off, like, I'm a black woman. I can't take my skin off." And that's really powerful, because that is the existence for a lot of athletes, because sometimes people forget that they're actual people. And so, yes, when Natasha Cloud takes her jersey off, of course she's impacted by all the things that happen in our country. And so what did you get? You got a league full of women who were sadly used to being held back, right? Used to being judged. We were never judged based on our basketball game, very rarely. All the conversations were about the makeup of our league. So when it came time for us to stand up for ourselves, we had no problem doing it. And we were able, because of that experience, like literal decades of being held back and told we had no value, we had no problem extending that hand. We understood, because that's the community and the support that we have. So you bring up the Minnesota Lynx, and I think, you know, that summer, the summer of 2016, what that taught us. Because Minnesota, they were the first team to wear their t-shirts. And then shortly thereafter, the New York Liberty. And then slowly but surely, the rest of the league started doing it. Some players were kneeling. Some teams were wearing black shirts. Our team in Seattle, we wore black shirts. We did a media blackout where we wouldn't answer any other questions, or we wouldn't answer questions about basketball, just about, you know, what we were trying to do as a league in that moment. And this is what we learned. And this is what we took with us to 2020. And we were able to have even more impact then. It's bigger, better, and louder when we do it united. And what we learned is, like, oh, when there's 144 players, 12 teams, 12 roster spots, we always call it 144. When 144 do it, you can't turn away. ESPN has to cover it. People are just going to notice it. And I think that's what you saw in 2020 when we wore the Vote Warnock t-shirts.
Yes, the Vote Warnock t-shirts.
That right there is by far one of the most proud moments of my career. I mean, I remember
electoral outcomes. I love that.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, there is a documentary about it called Power of the Dream. But the very, like, short version of this is, we didn't set out to do that necessarily. The owner of the Atlanta Dream at the time was a sitting Republican senator. And she challenged us and our desire to have Black Lives Matter on the court during the 2020 WNBA season. Again, we call it the bubble, sometimes the wobble season. You know, unprecedented times with the pandemic, and of course, Black lives literally being taken right in front of our eyes. She challenged us on our desire to have say her name, Breonna Taylor's name, on our jerseys. She was very anti this. And it really was just at the start, strategizing around what our reaction to that would be. And very quickly we realized, the louder we were about this, the more it was going to help her be able to go on Fox News, to be able to go on whatever network and say, oh, look at me. Look at these WNBA players making noise, and look at me standing up to them. And that was only going to help her. And once that set in, and once that clicked for us, we were like, oh, shit, we're pawns. And what was the only natural reaction? To not say her name, to not talk about her, to not create noise. But what didn't feel good was not standing up for ourselves at all. So then it became, okay, well, what can we do? And then it was like, oh, boom, we support her competition. We immediately got on the phone with the people that we trust the most. Stacey Abrams was a big player in that Lisa Borders, who was actually a former WNBA president who was working with Warnock's campaign at the time, was a big player in that. And then, of course, ultimately, we talked to Reverend Warnock himself to make sure we didn't want to just support anybody. We needed to support somebody that we would want in office, that we felt like we were aligned with from a value standpoint. And we were. And that made it easy. And to see what ultimately happened, which is Reverend Warnock get that Senate seat and beat Kelly Loeffler in that race. It went into a runoff. I learned a lot about politics that year, let me tell you. I remember it was my dad who actually played a pivotal role. He helped me learn quickly about all of this. At that point, I only had 4 gold medals, so it's a little dated. But he was like, you think 4 gold medals is an accomplishment? He's like, this is an accomplishment. Aww. And it's true, because this is lasting, right? Like, there's going to be other players who win gold medals and break records and have championships and assists and whatever you want to pick from it. But this is the type of change where it's lasting and it's so important, especially in 2020.
I love that moment from your dad. That's really cool. I can imagine as a parent that he's just been proud of you so many times over. So to hear him kind of express a unique pride in your efforts to help Warnock get elected is really cool. You have said in a recent interview that your coach, Gino Auriemma, your UConn coach, gave the best advice from a coach that you've ever received. He would say, basketball is not a game of how to, it's a game of when to. You, alongside a variety of other prominent athletes, have come out in support of trans athletes back in the spring, competing on a team consistent with their gender identity in the NCAA after a legal challenge was levied by some cisgender athletes who said the inclusion of trans people on their teams discriminates against them. Now, despite what you or I want to believe, trans athletes playing on women's teams in specific is still a very contentious political issue. Why was this the right moment, the when to lend your name and voice? And how do you think about that more broadly?
Yeah, I think the quick answer to your question is it was being hijacked and being the conversation around trans athletes was being hijacked and used to influence politics. And it was like, hold up, because I've been playing sports a long time, and the trans athlete, particularly in women's sports, has not been a problem. There hasn't been a takeover, you know. This is like fear mongering at its best, and it's being weaponized so people will vote to get these Republicans into whatever seat, whatever role they were going for. And it's just being used to scare people. And it was sadly working, because even in some of my smaller circles in the world of women's sports, it wasn't that people were like, they weren't saying that they supported it, but it was more like, huh, so what would happen? Wait, are there a lot of trans people were like, wait, is this a thing? And you're like, oh my God, it's creeping in. They are slowly creeping into all of these psyches. And if you don't go out of your way to educate or, you know, just become more knowledgeable about it, the fear of it all is going to impact. And so that's really, I mean, that to me is the when to of it all.
Another when to moment that I feel is important to talk about, and we mentioned this a little bit earlier, is when you decided to come out publicly in 2017. You and have said many times over, I was already out. I was out to my friends, I was out to my family, I was out to my coaches, I was out. Then Megan comes into your life and has a bit of a different take. Can you tell me a little bit more about those conversations? Because I'm guessing it was more than one. And also, what do you wish you could tell your then hesitant self about what you know now?
I mean, I'd probably tell her to pull the Band-Aid, for lack of a better, kind of like do it sooner. I think I'm laughing because we still have this conversation, not in any kind of like adversarial way, but it still comes up. Because when I think back to my conversations with Megan, she was the one that was encouraging me of saying it publicly. And that was really the difference. I was getting a little bit into the weeds and semantics of that. Like, what do you mean say it public? Like, I walk down the street holding your hand.
Yeah.
But I get it as a
known cultural figure.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm like, what do you call it?
You're welcome. Yeah. I was like, I can say it. I can say
it. Exactly. Yeah. As a known cultural figure, she was just pointing out, emphasizing to me that this can change people's lives. You can change the narrative around how they speak about gay athletes, particularly more straight looking women. Like I can easily pat, or at the time, I've taken a turn in my style. So sometimes, you know, it's not so easy, but I could easily pass for straight. So changing that narrative, that's unique to me. And then also helping people be more comfortable. Like her point was people are still dying just because they're gay. And this can help with that. So obviously, you know, there's no argument to that. And then it just became about when to do it, which happened really organically, which I loved. But this nice other part of it is, look at athletes today. They don't even have to come out. So you can, to see like immediate change rarely happens in our world. And so that feels really good. But yeah, that was really the helping, like quite literally helping people and saving lives, you know? And so my advice to my younger self would be like, do it sooner. I was ready. It was on the tip of my tongue for years. I think like in typical classic, like, I don't know if this is just lesbians. I'm sure it's just gay people in general. Form. I needed the girlfriend to do it. It gave me that, like, you know, yeah. I needed that little comfort, that blankie.
For sure. It's different having a partner.
Yeah.
So speaking of partners in life, Megan is also your partner in work. I want to touch on a bit of what the two of you are working on right now, because retirement is really busy if you're Sue Bird. You and Megan have started A Touch More Live, a podcast in partnership with Vox Media. Mm-hmm. You also have A Touch More Productions, where you're developing different storytelling projects. You've also then got Together, which is a media and commerce company with other fellow women athletes, Alex Morgan, Simone Manuel, and Chloe Kim. Folks listening might recognize Together's work on social media, where they amplify women's sports content, but also maybe from the amazing shirts that y'all are selling that say everyone watches women's sports. It's actually so fun to see those shirts out in the wild. And it's my favorite to see little boys or, I don't know, old men wearing those shirts, or to see the shirts like prominently featured courtside at a game. Why all of this focus on content storytelling and representation right now? Why is that where you're putting your effort?
That's super easy to answer. There was such a gaping hole that I think anyone who was in this world could see. And the way that, especially in women's basketball, the way that the coverage has played out, you know, now that, you know, Caitlin and Angel and the other rookies have entered the WNBA and there's been this kaboom, you see it, the coverage, you see that the coverage is lacking in some ways. And really where I've landed on that in specifically is the coverage of sports has to have an ecosystem of sorts. And I always say, I'm like, now, if you want to get into a conversation about why the hot takes are problematic, or, you know, why clickbait is bad for us all, great. But that is the world we live in. And what was happening was, And by the way, Megan and I and a bunch of other people, like, we saw this years ago, that there was just a lack of coverage, a lack of storytelling, a lack of nuanced storytelling. We saw it. But then again, fast forwarding to present time, the way it's played out has only proved us right, in that we have a lot of hot takes. A lot of them are wrong. We have a lot of clickbait. We know what that's doing. But where is the experts? Why don't they have a platform, right? Because they exist. Whether it's commentators that have been in our world for a long time, or the athlete themselves, like myself, Megan, and so many others, where's the platform that exists for them to get the mic and for that to be a part of this ecosystem, if we call it that? And that's really, so we knew that was missing for a long time. Again, this just proved our point.
Totally. That makes a lot of sense. Well, I can say that I'm personally really excited to see all the work that you're doing. And I think we're ready to support as more of these media projects come out. I want to end on a theme that really stood out to me from your documentary. And I feel like we can see this theme play out in your work on and off the court. In the film, so many people around you talk about your leadership style being this kind of quieter version of what we're used to seeing in competitive sports or in leadership at large. especially I think when we think about the kind of trope of a leader, a louder, potentially egocentric, strong man boss person, right? Mm-hmm. People see that kind of style of leadership coming, but maybe not the style that you embody. It seems that this is how you've operated across the board and all the different projects you've taken on, whether that be advocating for better playing conditions in the collective bargaining agreement for the WNBA, the consideration you give your activism, and on the court. One thing that's notable that we haven't really talked about is that you played point guard, which for the less basketball literate people means that you made the points happen. You called the plays, you organized the people, you found the opportunities. And where I'm going with this is that, you know, I think at the ACLU, we always say there's a role for everyone in change making and accomplishing a goal, moving a needle forward. And that it's really important that we embrace kind of like our best and highest value in change making. So I guess as we wrap up here today, I wonder what you can tell the people about this style of quiet leadership that you embody. And I don't know, if there are people in the audience who might be quieter as well, what would you want to say to them as people who might often get overlooked?
I mean, I think especially when it comes to leadership, you can't be something you're not. That has to be the foundation. I have played for a lot of coaches. I can't even tell you how many teammates. And the second somebody shows up as something that is inauthentic to them, it's such a turnoff. Nobody is following that person. Nobody's following that person. Obviously, I'm sure there's a counter to that where if the charisma is off the charts, then maybe that can work out. But generally speaking, if you're not being like your authentic self, people smell it. They can just notice it and you're not following that. So for all the, you know, for all the tougher aspects of being a quiet, maybe introverted for some leader, and yes, some of that falls in the category of getting the credit or the notoriety or being talked about in certain ways in terms of your impact. That's a trade-off I think you have to be willing to take if it means you're being yourself. I couldn't have been any other leader. It just wouldn't have hit. I could only be the leader I was. And yeah, some of that, again, the lack of acknowledgement, some of that does exist for sure. You're going to get overlooked. And then at the end of the day, you're still having the impact. You're still, you know, for me in my world, I was still winning the championships, right? One of the things my teammates and I had a genuine relationship because of that. It's why I was able to lead the teams. The things I could say about myself that I'm proud of, and I know it's not for everybody, but it works for me. I know that I could go on a basketball court, whether it's the WNBA, the Olympics, the highest of highest levels, I could have not one point. I could have zero assists. It could be a total zero across my box score. And yet you would know I was in that game. And my impact and my fingerprints would be all over that game. And we'd probably win. I could say that now I'm retired. You could talk a little more shit. my point being, I knew my impact had nothing to do with the sexier things of the game. Because you know what? It is sexy to have a lot of points or a lot of assists or fill up that score sheet. It's super sexy to do that and you're going to get talked about. But I knew that my impact went beyond that. And that was something that when I went to bed at night, felt good.
That's awesome. Sue, thank you so much for doing this. This was so lovely to chat with you. And thank you for all of your leadership and work across the board to advance women in sports. It's been really awesome to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored that I am a bookend. So shout out to you in your final recording.
Thanks. Thanks so much. My dear audience, as Sue mentioned, this is my last recording as producer and host of At Liberty. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks so much to Sue for joining this special episode. I've been working on this podcast since December of 2019, when I started as the executive producer. I then became host in addition to that role, and it's been such an honor to share the past I think 250 episodes with you. I've learned so much as a storyteller, an advocate, and a person, honestly, from all who have taken the mic. One lesson, however, stands out over them all. Our civil rights and civil liberties are inextricably linked, and our liberation relies on it all. We must be chipping away at every issue, doing what we can, where we can. If you're interested in what I'm up to next, feel free to find me on the internet. At Liberty will come back from hiatus in September, so stay tuned for new episodes then. Have a great August, and until next time, stay strong. At Liberty is a production of the ACLU, produced by me, Kendall Seesmeyer, and Vanessa Handy. This episode was edited by Carrie Daniels. Joy Smith-McCauley is our intern.